Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We read to try to make sense of life, of the world. There was a lot to work on in 2010. We're looking today at the year's best books with some first-class readers and you. Franzen's out with Freedom, Salman Rushdie's back, Jay-Z is chipping in, Patti Smith is on the boards, Mark Twain speaks up from the grave. What moved you, won your mind, your heart in the world of books this year? This hour on Point, the best books of 2010. You can join the conversation. What moved you, delighted you, what are you recommending? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And let us know your city and state when you comment online. We've got three fine readers with us today. You can see their lists, the lists of their top books of the year online at onpointradio.org, where you can also listen to a selection of our past shows on books and authors. Joining us from New York City is Laura Miller, senior writer and book critic for Salon.com, one of the site's co-founders. She also writes for the New York Times Book Review. She's author of The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. Laura Miller, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
It's great to be with you.
With us from Houston, Texas is Maggie Galehouse, book editor at the Houston Chronicle, where she also writes the blog Bookish. Maggie, thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Tom.
And with us from San Francisco is Paul Yamazaki. He's head buyer at San Francisco's famed City Lights Books, which published Allen Ginsberg's Howl and other poems back in 1956. Still a lot going on there. This year, City Lights won Publishers Weekly's Bookseller of the Year Award. And, Paul, I understand you celebrated your 40th year at City Lights. Wow. Paul Yamazaki, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. That is a lot of experience.
Yeah.
We've got lists, and we will get just as deeply into each of yours as we can here. A few readings up our sleeve as well. Laura, let me come first to you just on Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, because it got so much hoopla when it came out. Here we are just a few months later. It's on your list. How's it wearing, Laura? What is it after the hoopla that makes it stand up for you?
Well, I read it before the hoopla, and I was looking forward to it very eagerly, and I wasn't disappointed. My experience of it, I feel that, you know, often too much of our opinion is formed by the publicity surrounding a book instead of our experience reading the book. And for me, since I didn't really have that kind of prejudice coming in, I wasn't in a, you know, I wasn't sort of feeling combative with big publications that had touted it as the book of the year,
right.
And I read it and I just was completely transfixed by it. The hours just melted away while I was reading. I loved it.
You write about it: plot summary can't convey the scope, humor, pathos, and intelligence of this novel. What is it in a nutshell for those who haven't broached it?
Well, it's the story of a family that sort of falls apart and comes back together again from the 80s to the early 2000s. And one of the reasons why the plot summary doesn't really work is every time you describe it to someone, they kind of go, huh, you know, that doesn't sound very appealing. It's not a high concept book for all the slogans attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just about what it's been like to be alive for the past 20 or 30 years.
About the Berglund family, you write, and their flailing attempts to reconcile conscience and contentment in Bush-era America.
Yeah.
There's your high concept stab at it.
Yeah.
does it leave you, I don't know, up, down, or neutral on the America of this last decade and maybe the future?
You know, I sort of feel like a book that is meant to, a novel that is meant to sort of ratchet you up or bum you out is going to be a kind of a second-rate novel.
Mm-hmm.
You should close the book
is.
Feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you should close the book feeling as if your sense of something has been deepened, your sense of what it's like to be alive or to be a human being. And that's definitely how I felt when I finished Freedom.
Maggie Galehouse, you've got The Infinities by John Banville right up high on your fiction list. Tell us about it.
Well, I'm afraid it's sort of like the Franzen novel. Once you start, it might sound too crazy to even want to read. It's a family in Ireland. The father, the patriarch, is dying, and he is a theoretical mathematician. And at his bedside is his real-life family and a collection of meddlesome gods who sort of go in and out and have their way with certain people, make mischief, that kind of thing. It's a romp, but I think that he, Banville, he's very smart. His vocabulary is incredible. So it's one of those books I think there's something for everybody in it.
A modern-day retelling of the myth of Amphitryon, Zeus seduces a mortal woman while disguised as her husband. How literal
That's
is
just,
the retelling?
You know, it's pretty literal, actually. It really is. But I mean, in addition to the gods, there's a sense of Molière. There's a sense of drama in the book. You know, it takes place in, I think it's a house called Arden. So there's Shakespeare there. You sort of get the sense that you're watching it happen. It takes place over one day, and that you're watching it in a house that sort of doesn't have a front on it. Things are happening in front of you in a million, you know, sort of like I think that TV show 24, where things happen all over the screen, more than one spot. So it's, it's kind of a multiple, experience. And it's quite funny, too, which is important to me as a reader.
We'll take that. And Zeus moving in on the marriage there gets our attention. Paul, you've got a great American, I don't know, jazz novel, it's been described, right up high on your list. From a Broken Bottle, Traces of Perfume Still Emanate by Nathaniel Mackey. What is it, Paul?
Well, Mackey is a great poet. He won the National Book Award for Poetry in 2006. And this is a book that he's been working on for the last
forever
22 years. Right. And so it's like this is the first time that all four of these have been in print together. So they've all been published as separate novels over a 22-year period. And it's an epistolary novel that looks at the development of black thought, black arts over these last 30 or 40 years, and the language is incredible. If one is attuned to like modern cultural changes over the last 30 or 40 years, this is really kind of a very interesting place to start.
It's there are letters here to this mysterious angel of dust. Is it jazz style in its prose and its rendering, Paul?
It is. It's very improvisational in the sense of the feeling that you get. So you can actually have a soundtrack of Charles Mingus, of John Coltrane, of Thelonious Monk that would run perfectly well with reading this book.
From a Broken Bottle, Traces of Perfume Still Emanate by Nathaniel Mackey. Laura, you've got Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns high on your list. This has had a lot of attention as well. She sounds pretty terrific whenever I've heard her speak about the mid-20th century migration of African Americans from south to north in this country.
Yeah, this is a major work of contemporary American history. She's been working on it for, at least 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it's really about the transfer of nearly half of the African-American population of the South to cities in the North and the West. And this has just been looked at in various different ways by historians. I mean, they tend to see it as, just the, movement of people within the nation and in the way that maybe, I might move to L.A. to get a job.
Right.
But she reframes it, and this is what makes this book really impressive, is that she takes the established sort of facts that we all know about this movement of population, and she reframes it as an immigration story, and part of the American tradition that includes people coming across the Atlantic.
Read a little bit right from the top? I think got a reading for us there,
and it'll give you a sense of the beautiful style. And I should add that she tells a story through the stories of three families. Mm-hmm.
It's very warmth of other suns.
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Okay. They fled as if under a spell or a high fever. They left as though they were fleeing some curse, wrote the scholar Emmett J. Scott. They were willing to make almost any sacrifice to obtain a railroad ticket, and they left with the intention of staying. From the early years of the 20th century to well past its middle age, nearly every black family in the American South, which meant nearly every black family in America, had a decision to make. There were sharecroppers losing at settlement, typists wanting to work in an office, yard boys scared that a single gesture near the planter's wife would leave them hanging from an oak tree. They were all stuck in a caste system as hard and unyielding as the red Georgia clay, and they each had a decision before them. In this, they were not unlike anyone who ever had to cross the Atlantic or the Rio Grande.
From Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, and here we learned something about our country that we thought we understood, but there's much more to it, Laura.
Yeah, history is telling a story, and you can change the focus of the story in a certain way and give it an entirely new meaning.
You know, it's kind of incredible, Maggie. I don't know how often you find this. I look across each of your lists, and as I say, they're up at the website, onpointradio.org, but they're essentially, each of you have given us 10 different books, practically, out of this year's plentitude. You know, everybody's got their own taste here when it comes to favorite.
Well, you know, one thing I would say, I think Laura and I both have the Franzen novel and the Wilkerson. So
okay,
that's
yes,
two.
Good.
That's
There's
pretty good.
Good.
That's
yes.
two out of, you know, I get probably 50 books a day
yes.
at the newspaper. You know, never go to a book room at a newspaper. You'll never write a word.
Right.
But no, it is. There is so much. And it's really difficult as a reader to know what to do. I mean, we're busy people, you know, and it's so hard to sort of decide what you're going to, you know, what you're going to invest your time in. I mean, absolutely. And I do think, you know, I agree with what Laura was saying. I think the Wilkerson book is, it's sort of a masterpiece of journalism, and it's a story well told. And I mean, I would encourage anybody to go and buy that book and read it. There's something there for everyone.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about best books of the year 2010 this hour with Laura Miller from Salon.com, author of The Magician's Book herself. Maggie Galehouse is with us from Houston, Texas, book editor at the Houston Chronicle. She writes the Bookish blog there. And Paul Yamazaki at the great San Francisco's Great City Lights Books just won the Publishers Weekly Bookseller of the Year Award for 2010. Paul joins us from California. Paul, Maggie, Laura, we've got lots of feedback here. Rebecca says Franzen was great, but her number one was Solar by Ian McEwan, also moved by Chang Rae Lee's The Surrendered. Joseph writes that his favorite was Just Kids by Patti Smith. We talked with her here just last week. I read that. I thought that was just terrific and really recommend it. Let's get one more. Claire, Montpelier, Vermont. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, my recommendation is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. Definitely one of the best books I read this year. And I think Egan is definitely recognized by the critics, but I'm not sure if the general public knows how brilliant and incredibly original her stories are.
Tell us about the book.
Well, it's a series of different stories that make up a bigger story. Separate chapters make up the bigger story, and it's about different people in the music industry from starting in the 70s, and it ends in the near future. So it kind of spans time, and the Goon Squad of the title is time itself.
Time itself.
And she is just, she's brilliant. She's entirely original. She has a great take on modern technology and its effect on society. And she tells a good story.
Claire, we love it. Thanks for calling. Laura, this made your list. I mean, it's got a little bit of Paul's backyard there, Bay Area punk rock in it, but also, you know, sort of looking at how rebellion ages, lifelong friendships fluctuate. How did it make your list, Laura?
Well, this is one of those books that kind of sneaks up on you. At first, you're sort of reading about some a couple of teenage girlfriends going to the famous punk rock club of in San Francisco in the 70s, and then you're with this family that's kind of falling apart on an African safari, and then you're with this woman who's stealing her date's wallet, and you know, it's just you think, oh, you know, these are really great stories, but then over time, you see that the characters are all connected, and because the narrative moves back and forth in time, you get a sense of how the kind of purity and idealism and excitement of youth changes over the years. And and you know, all of a sudden you realize that you're actually in this really big story, and it's kind of devastating because it doesn't come out at you saying, "This is big." You know, it just kind of grabs you, it kidnaps you, and runs off with you. So it's just a wonderful book. And she, you know, her last novel, The Keep, was also really great. It was kind of this gothic romp, but this one really kind of takes her to a new level. And probably the most commented upon aspect of it is that one of the chapters is, which is one of the ones set in the near future, is a paper that one of the characters' daughters writes for school that's presented in PowerPoint. It's about the great pauses in rock music, the great silences in rock music, which I think is such a wonderful topic.
A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. Plenty of Bay Area in there. Paul, you've got the Bay Area right in the middle of one of your top picks this year, and it's a book that brings San Francisco to life. You describe it. It's called Infinite City. Rebecca Solnit brings it to us. What is it, Paul?
Well, what Rebecca has done here is really kind of put together this series of maps that are layered. I mean, she has put together a variety of artists and writers to give a multiple series of looks at San Francisco. And it's part of what's been happening here. We can look over the last 60 years and from, like, you know, Robert Duncan and Madeline Gleason and Rebecca Solnit, mm-hmm. I mean, and Kenneth Rexroth, and draw a straight line to, like, Litquake and to 826 Valencia that Dave Eggers does. And so what Rebecca tries to do is to look at all the varieties, histories, all the varieties of way of looking at a city through maps and through kind of, you know, art and literature.
Give us a sense. I mean, is it really literally maps? Is there prose here as well? Are they woven together? Is it literature or something else?
It is all those things. I mean, this is one of the things of books as object that can't be replicated on a Kindle or any other ebook device. So there's a series of gorgeous maps. She worked with a lot of topographers and artists to collaborate on all these different ways to look at it. So she looks at, for example, one map looks both at kind of the emergence of gay culture and the disappearance of, like, butterflies in San Francisco, and where to find and where these kind of nests for these still exist.
Wow. Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas by Rebecca Solnit. Let's go to Tina in East Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Tina. What do you see? What are you reading?
Hi, how are you?
Pretty well.
My book club just finished The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and I love that. Very, very nicely done. I like all three parts of it, kind of coming together from the scientific and the life stories.
And this is about what the cell tissue of an African-American woman who was put to enormous use in the expanse of science without her family ever knowing about it, and then them learning.
Ever knowing. So interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And people who love science and stuff about cells and biology will also like it. It's very interesting.
The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. What else is on or not on your list, Tina?
Well, you know what I wanted to say? I did not like Freedom. Our book club read it. It was very long. Lots of words on the page. So not only long, but very wordy. And I must confess that the book club was reading it. So I read the first 100 pages very slowly because I didn't care for it, and I needed to finish it, so I read the last 150. First 150, last 150.
So Jonathan Franzen's made up with Oprah, but he's not making up with you.
No, did not miss a whole lot in the middle.
Okay, what else?
I love The Help.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that was last year's, right?
Yeah, but a lot of people still reading.
My all-time favorite is Warriors Don't Cry.
Don't know it. Who wrote that one?
You know, I can't remember. It's about the civil rights movement and people in Birmingham, the Birmingham 12.
Terrific, terrific. Thank you so much for your call, Tina. Maggie, take us on down your list. You've got Justin Crone in there with the passage. He's got a Houston connection, doesn't he? This is kind of a vampire.
He does. Yeah. Well, he calls them virals, and I'm not sure how big a distinction that is. You know, you can take that distinction or not. He's actually a professor at Rice University. He taught in Philadelphia at LaSalle for a while, and yeah, he started working on this before the kind of vampire boom. And it's, you know, it's the passage came out in the middle of this year. And I liked it. It's not the kind of book I ordinarily read. And I think I liked it because it was a big sort of deep dish story with lots and lots of characters, really beautifully written. And it is about virals. It's sort of about, it's an apocalyptic novel. There's a scientific experiment that's gone terribly wrong. And, you know, and people are getting infected by these beings who were supposed to be sort of masterful race that would heal from all wounds, like the ultimate warrior kind of people. But of course, the experiment goes wrong and they become virals and they need, you know, blood to feed on. So I liked it.
Yeah. And The Possessed, Laura, takes us to right out of the American reading circle into a real Russian reading circle.
Yes, mostly Russian. This is a collection of essays, although it's, you know, essay is kind of a funny word for them because they're also sort of like memoir, by a woman named Elif Batuman.
Turkish,
who is Turkish-American and from New Jersey. So she's not Russian, but she has been obsessed with Russian literature since her girlhood. And so these are stories of sort of her adventures in academia. They're just these completely hilarious and revealing descriptions of these crazy academic conferences where these Russian, you know, Russian people come and make these scenes and behave in these peculiar ways. And there's a great kind of ongoing story about how she wound up in the city, the fabled city of Samarkand, which turns out not to be actually as glamorous as she had hoped.
Sounds great. It's a beautiful word, Samarkand.
Yeah. She's studying this language, which kind of doesn't really exist, and she can't find any books printed. It's she gets into one absurd situation after another. It's one of the funniest, sort of drollest, most charming books I've read in years.
Can you read us just a little bit from Elif Batuman's The Possessed?
I'll give an introduction. She's studying this language called Old Uzbek, which is kind of a Soviet invention. And her teacher is a woman named Delorum. And the main thing to remember is that the Uzbeks really resent the Persians. So this is kind of comes out of a feud. Persian, Delorum told me, had only one word for crying, whereas Old Uzbek had 100. Old Uzbek had words for wanting to cry and not being able to, for being caused to sob by something, for loudly crying like thunder in the clouds, for crying in gasps, for weeping inwardly or secretly, for crying ceaselessly in a high voice, for crying in hiccups, and for crying while uttering the sound, hey, hey. Old Uzbek had special verbs for being unable to sleep, for speaking while feeding animals, for being a hypocrite, for gazing imploringly into a lover's face, for dispersing a crowd. It was all just like a Borges story, except that Borges stories are always so short, whereas life in Samarkand kept dragging obscurely on and on.
From Possessed by Elif Batuman there. And what is it that she finds in Russian literature that or life that she hasn't found, you know, in her American or Turkish-American surrounding?
I think she finds a drama and she finds eccentricity and the unexpected. But she's the woman who seems to attract these things. I mean, she has this whole description of her circle of friends in grad school where they turn out to be reenacting the plot of this Dostoevsky novel called The Demons, which is a very aptly titled novel. And then one of them winds up joining a monastery, and she can never see him again because no women are allowed. And it's just so funny. You can't believe that when she was traveling in Europe, she wound up being kind of shanghaied into judging the best legs contest at a Hungarian boys' camp. I mean, there are just these experiences that some people, wherever they go, they fall into these crazy experiences, and she's one of them. And so this is sort of like a kind of an Augustine Burroughs for people who really love Russian literature.
That sounds great. Let's get a call from John in Boston. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
It's still going on.
Hello, John. John, you're on the air, my friend.
So I'm like listening. thing ever do.
John's got another conversation going on. That's all right. Let's get one from Kale in Spokane, Washington. Let's go to Spokane. And Kale, thanks for calling. Kale, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me on the air. I was just wondering if any of the panel have read any of the Honor Harrington series by David Weber. And if they have, what do they think about a book written by a male author that has a very strong female lead? I'll take my answer off the air.
Let me be sure I've got it. David Weber, Honor Harrington. Help me, panel. Paul, do you know?
No, I'm not aware of that.
Maggie, Laura?
Sorry.
Nope.
Oh, geez. Well, hey, it's a male writer who really understands how to write women. We'll put it up there, Honor Harrington sci-fi series. Paul, you've got, Laura was talking about drama and eccentricity. You've got Jim Nesbitt in here. Maybe that's in the same quadrant. I don't know. But with Windward Passage, tell us about Jim and Windward Passage.
Well, Jim is one of the San Francisco authors who has been writing for over 25 years and until very recently had been really underpublished in the United States. He's had 12 books published in France over this period of time where he's had so little success in finding his books published here. But Overlook, Peter Mayer at Overlook, is kind of going to be doing most of Jim's backlist. And this is his most – Windward Passage is Jim's most recent book. And it's one of those kind of epic novels of mystery, of drug smuggling, of stolen DNA that it's – you know, it's kind of – if you – crossed Melville and Jim Thompson, that might give you a sense of where Jim is coming from in these books. But he is a marvelous writer, a great storyteller, and I think I really congratulate Overlook on like bringing Jim Nesbitt to an American audience.
Would you bring a little reading to us there, Paul, from Windward Passage?
Yes. Just to give a little bit of context, mm-hmm. One of the protagonists in the book, who actually doesn't spend that much time on here because he dies quite early in the book but continues to live in his letters to his sister, is in the midst of being on a sinking sailboat, and he knows that his time is limited. And I'm just going to read you a very short passage from here. Mm-hmm. Oxycodone is a synthetic morphine. A quarter of merely one of those blue pills which led a normal person straight to oblivion. Taken all at once and chewed to obviate their time-release function, Charlie figured certainly four of them should compromise a thorough overdose. As he computed these matters, Valela, Valela, which is the boat he's on, Charlie pitched backwards but managed to turn to. His left shoulder impacted the back of the house on the starboard side of the companionway. He contrived to roll his momentum through the cockpit water, making a fist around the pills he rotated. He wound up on his back, head underwater, pills held aloft. The pain was sufficient to take his breath away, but not so much that he couldn't roar as he surfaced.
On his back, head underwater, pills, yeah. Pills held aloft. There's an image. Save the pills, but the boat's going down.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah, Paul, reading there from Windward Passage by Jim Nesbitt. Alan in Boston. Alan, you're on the air.
Very good show. Love to hear this type of dialogue. I read the Stieg Larsson series, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoos, three books comprising about 1,800 pages, and it's really great reading. It might be a little bit base for your listening audience, but it goes in a lot of different details about women's rights, mistreatment of women, government infiltration of Nazis and fascism, and state interference in psychiatric care of the female protagonist, Lisbeth Van Zylander. Great book, great series. I'm looking forward to the movie.
Yeah, you and a lot of others who have gotten caught up in Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Maggie Gelhaus, I mean, that was up here last year, and it's still rolling out this year as we talk about it. You know, where do you put it? I have to admit, I read it front to back. Guilty pleasure, great beach book, maybe more than that. Awful lot of people have gone to this.
People are crazy for this trilogy, and I'm sorry to say I haven't read it, and that's one of my I have to be honest, you know, the list that you come up with for the best books, they have to be books you've read or else you won't be able to talk about them. But, you know, I do have all three of them on my bookshelf. It's my Christmas, you know, it's my Christmas treat to myself.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about best books of 2010.
Favorites of Laura Miller at Salon.com, Maggie Galehouse at the Houston Chronicle, and Paul Yamazaki joins us from San Francisco. He's head buyer at City Lights Books there, been there for 40 years. We're looking at this year's big books, at least big on your bookshelf. Whether they're big publishers or small, we're interested. What's on your must-read list? Maggie, I love someone here. Salman Rushdie's back. Luca yes. and the Fire of Life. This is what follow-up. He's talking to kids here, not only, but certainly.
Exactly. Yeah, no, this is a it's sort of follow-up to an earlier book called Haroon and the Sea of Stories.
Oh, yeah, he wrote the first. Yeah.
Yes, he wrote the first book for his older son, Zafar. And this book, because his children are 18 years apart, and the younger son said, hey, you know, I want a book too.
What about me?
What about me? So he wrote Luca and the Fire of Life for his son Milan, and it's a very fun book. It's for parents too, and mm-hmm. for children, and it sort of has the there seems to be a gods theme with me, but there's a lot of out of work gods in this particular book. And it sort of works like a video game. Basically, this little boy has to he's insulted a god, and in retaliation the god has put his father, who is a storyteller, in a coma, and Luca has to go to the world of magic and bring back the fire of life to save his father. He goes to one level and the next, and it works like a video game. He gathers lives, and then he loses them all and disintegrates and, you know, reforms back into himself. So it's fun for, I think, you know, across generations.
I got a real soft spot for Haroon and the Sea of Stories.
I
saw that lapped up years ago. You've got Jay-Z on here as well, Decoded, his book about music, the music business is coming up. I mean,
yeah.
I have to say, I didn't know what to think, but it does sound awfully good.
It's, you know, it's funny. I mean, I really know nothing about hip hop, so this is the book for me, you know, but it's really a book that kind of you can't put down. It sort of feels like an artifact. It's kind of a chapbook. It's actually got 36 of his songs. It's got lyrics and then very long footnotes on the other side of the page, sort of like T.S. Eliot mm-hmm. in The Wasteland, if you can imagine, but with all kinds of cool pictures. And it's not a book you'd sit down and read straight through. It's one you want kind of hanging around. And it's slick, you know. It's like no expense has been spared. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I heard him talking about it, and I was absolutely taken with Jay-Z and Decoded. And I have to say, again, talking with Patti Smith, Just Kids is just a heck of a good read and a really, really deeply felt book about coming of age as an artist. Jane in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Jane, you're on the air.
Hi. I had two books, one nonfiction and one a fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The nonfiction is The Other Wes Moore by Wes Moore, and it's a story of a young man growing up in the inner-city Bronx with no father, skirting on the edge of gangs, who ended up becoming a Rhodes Scholar. And the day his Rhodes Scholar is announced, he sees in the paper an article about a Wes Moore growing up in the Bronx who had just gotten sentenced to life in prison for murder.
Wow.
And he became intrigued and started corresponding with him and then interviewing and meeting him. And he writes a story of their parallel lives.
The Other Wes Moore. You've got my attention right away with that brief description,
and it's
Jane.
It's a great discussion book for how do we change the situation of so many inner city kids ending up in prison for life.
The Other Wes Moore sounds great. What else on your list, Jane?
The other was Cutting for Stone by Abraham
Verghese. Oh, yeah.
It's a long story, but a wonderful story about the interwovenness of the different characters, and everybody in both of my book clubs love that, too.
I have heard people just rave about Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese.
It's a wonderful book.
What do you say about it, Paul? Why?
Well, I think what Abraham has done here is he takes place in the Horn of Africa, and you know, as he's of Indian descent, South Asian descent, and mm-hmm. It tells the story of a young family, East Indian family there, and it brings in so much history, so much great storytelling, the depth of character. And it's also just the level of physical detail in there, in the operating rooms, and of emotion, and also is able to kind of explicate the characters, and it's just wonderfully told. I think Verghese is somebody that we've known from his memoirs, but as a fiction writer, this was a real revelation.
Cutting
really love this book tremendously.
Stone. You and a lot of others. You've got another, speaking of history and personal stories. I didn't know this one at all. Devil Dog, the amazing true story of the man who saved America. What's that, Paul?
Well, this is a new called Pulp a series called Pulp History that David Talbot and Margaret Talbot are putting together. And this is the first one of this series. Pulp History tells the story of Smedley, a Marine general.
Smedley Butler.
Yes, Smedley Darlington Butler, who is one of the most decorated soldiers forever. But he becomes well-known because he was one of the first people to talk about the dangers of, like, you know, imperialism and its collusion with capitalism in this country. And so he came out as this ardent defender of democracy and of people's rights in the 30s. And it's but he had been forgotten to a lot of us, including myself. And then this is one of those books there that'd be hard to be anything other than a book, because what David has done is brought in Spain Rodriguez, a famed graphic novelist from the Zap days, and it's they have put together this incredibly engaging history that for any of us who kind of may not be kind of think when you think of a book of history that you may get turned off, but this is really engaging. The writing is very good. The level of historical research for images and as well as Spain's illustrations make this a really engaging book.
I love your list. You've got a very tangy taste in San Francisco. And this here, the most decorated Marine in history, Smedley Butler, who turns around and becomes a big champion of a kind of a political activist and human rights champion. And what, facing down Herbert Hoover and blowing the lid off a plot to overthrow FDR. I didn't know a bit of it, but it's all in Devil Dog from David Talbot. Rob in Lexington, Virginia. Rob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Hey, Brady Udall, The Lonely Polygamist.
Okay. What's that? Tell us.
I loved it. I worked part-time this last year in a independent bookstore.
Yeah.
And I saw it on a list of bestsellers among independent bookstores and had to get it for the store. And read it, loved it. With a title like that, I had to read the book.
How can a polygamist be lonely, Rob? Give us a hint.
Well, as a married man, I can't imagine having three other wives. I can see how it could get lonely if they all gang up on me. But but yeah, it told the story through not just his eyes, but the eyes of different members of his family. And one of the narratives goes through one of the eyes of his children. And it was funny. It was heartbreaking. It was storytelling at its best. It was in the 1970s in Nowheres, Utah, Rocky Mountains. I just loved the book.
The Lonely Polygamist by Barry Udall. Now, that's out. Is that out in Utah territory? Udall is a famous name. Is it in the family, Mo Udall and all that? Do you know, Rob?
Yeah, Brady Udall. If I said Barry, I'm sorry. Brady Udall.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds. It definitely sounds like a Utah name.
All right.
I lived for a time in Utah, but I didn't know much about the author before reading the book, but really enjoyed it. It is a work of fiction.
The Lonely Polygamist.
Great insight.
Yep. Yeah. Rob, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much for checking in there. Let's get another from New York, North Creek, New York. And Sue. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, my book is The Berlin-Baghdad Express. For a while, I wasn't sure we were doing any world history, so I'm throwing it in. I'm also, in full disclosure, related to the author.
Who wrote that? I've heard of it, but remind me, Berlin-Baghdad
Express. Sean McMeekin,
okay.
And it's in New York Review of Books this week, and it was in Wall Street Journal in August. Just essentially all the things Americans don't know about World War I, how the Middle East got involved, how it affected, you know, the whole Middle East and what's going on today. There was a jihad, essentially, back then. The Germany was trying to get everybody to, all the Muslims, to overthrow the British. And so it's just, I'm quoting, Wall Street Journal, very relevant to today, and very colorful characters. The Lawrence of Arabia's that were on the German side and the Turkish side, we never heard about, of course, because they lost.
The Berlin-Baghdad Express. You'll be welcome at the holiday table this year, Sue, by Sean McMeekin there. Maggie, you've got a little poetry just to expand our palette a bit here.
I do.
From Tony Hoagland. What's the name?
Tony Hoagland has written, very early this year, he wrote a collection called Unincorporated Persons in the Late Honda Dynasty. That would be all of us. And I have a little, do you want me to read a bit?
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah, it's the poem, this poem, it's just the beginning of a poem called The Loneliest Job in the World. As soon as you begin to ask the question, who loves me? You are completely screwed, because the next question is, how much? And then it is hundreds of hours later, and you are still hunched over your flowcharts and abacus, trying to decide if you have gotten enough. This is the loneliest job in the world, to be an accountant of the heart. I like this poem. I like Tony Hoagland. He teaches at the University of Houston. I like it because it's direct. He uses the word completely screwed, you know, sort of ordinary language. We all say things like that, or hear things like that. And it's sort of a self-conscious love poem about the loneliness of, you know, about sort of late at night when all the love's done, you're just, you know, looking at the charts and sort of tallying up your share. And I just think it's, I think he's good because he's accessible, and he uses humor. He writes about, you know, shopping malls and you know, hostesses at parties whose dresses slip off their shoulders, and, you know, watching demolitions. You know, he's got a lot of
there's a lot of
guts in his poems. Yeah, there is a great range. So
Unincorporated,
that's why I picked that.
Persons in the Late Honda Dynasty,
yes,
by Tony,
yes,
Hoagland. Little poetry there. That sounds great. Ellen in Boston. Ellen, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I love your show, Tom.
Well, thanks.
And I also love English novels, which I've been reading since I was about 10, starting with Jane Eyre and going through Dickens and Jane Austen. But anyway, my recommendation is A Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Groot, G-R-O-O-T, written by David Mitchell, who's one of the finalists for the Booker Prize.
Yes.
And I love these Booker Prize books. Last year, Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel was a wonderful book about Thomas Cromwell.
But this one is about a Dutchman in, is it, what, 18th, 19th century Japan, something?
Yeah, no, it's about 16th century Japan, about Edo, about this little island that was built by the Dutch Trading Company off the coast of Nagasaki. And it's a wonderful story, which he's researched so, so carefully. And he's a brilliant writer. And it's fascinating history and a wonderful love story. It's a long book, and he's just such a skilled writer, really, really gifted writer.
I am ardently longing to get to that one, Ellen. I'm jealous of you that you have already. Give us the title one more time. It's David Mitchell's.
It's called 1,000 Autumns, A-U-T, the season, autumn, of Jacob de Groot, G-R-O-O-T. Who knows how to pronounce it, but it's right.
Ellen, that's terrific. Thanks so much for reminding us of that one. One more right here. Virginia Beach, Virginia. Linda, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Good morning.
Hi.
I would like to recommend a nonfiction book called Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, by Bill McKibben, who is an environmentalist.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically, with that misspelling, says that Earth is no longer the planet that we've known for the past 10,000 years. And he kind of gives us an overview of where we are with all these changes that are occurring in the environment. And I read it because I'm intrigued by that. We live near the ocean, and we can see the waters rising. And the fact is, it's pretty hard to ignore after you read this book, and so I probably bought 10, 15 copies and handed them out to my children so that hopefully they will wisen up and teach my grandchildren that we need to be conservationists. We need to not let the water run all the time. And think about getting rid of the SUVs and look at the alternative energy sources.
Linda, I'm glad you raised it. It sounds like you've really got the Bill McKibben bug. He writes with so much passion and insight. He's right out there this year with Earth with two A's in it. Our time is short, but thank you, Linda. Let me get Lenore from Nashville. Lenore, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. One of my favorite books this year has been On the Corner of Bitter and Sweet.
Oh, I remember. I don't know if it's this year or last, but who wrote it again? I remember thinking about it, talking.
I can't remember who wrote it off the top of my head, but it's a lovely story about...
Jamie Ford. That's right, Jamie Ford.
Oh, that's right, Jamie Ford, yep. And it's about life in Seattle. And it talks about that time of the concentration camps that we had here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
with the Japanese.
Right. On the corner of Bitter and Sweet by Jamie Ford. Our time is getting short here, Lenore, but I appreciate your calling in with that. Laura, we're greedy for more. We're not going to get to everything here, but tell us about a couple more. Superstad, True Love Story. Gary Steingart is back. What's he up to?
Yeah, this is a story of the ill-starred love between a kind of a falling apart Russian Jewish American and a daughter of Korean immigrants. And it's set in the near future, and it is, you know, that rare satire that has a marvelously warm heart. So there's a lot of stuff about, social networking and the way we're all being encouraged to rate everything constantly all the time and look at everybody else's ratings and asks, you know, is love still possible in a world where we, you know, treat everything like a commodity. And it's really hilarious and also just very touching. I love this book by Gary Steingart.
Yeah, and Paul, a couple more from you. You've got Thelonious Monk on here by Robin Kelly. We talked with Robin. What a terrific book and a terrific story of the great jazz player. And you've got Karen Tay Yamashita, I Hotel. In a nutshell, what is it, Paul?
Well, Karen has taken an amazing Asian American history in the late 60s. I've been comparing it to Roberto Bolaño's Savage Detectives. One, because it takes a particular social grouping at a particular historical time and then marshals all these formal ways of looking at this. So Karen has taken 10 novellas to go through this, and it's just really a tremendous read. It was on the short list for the National Book Awards this year.
10 novellas of Asian American life in this country in the 60s and 70s. It's I, Hotel from Karen Tay Yamashita. Wow, I can hear the music telling us that we're not going to get to everything on these lists. We will put them up at our website, onpointradio.org, and we're so grateful to the three of you for pitching in with them. Paul Yamazaki at City Lights Books in San Francisco. Paul, thanks very much for your tips. We will we'll pick you up on just as many of them as we can. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Maggie Galehouse at the Houston Chronicle in Houston, Texas with us today. Maggie, thanks so much for your recommendations.
Thanks. It was great fun.
And Laura Miller, we always love reading you at Salon.com, New York Times Book Review. Thanks for being with us today, Laura.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for your tips as well. We'll be reading. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.